So the point is to match the energy and then slowly bring it down. So you match it with AC/DC. The next song maybe is Meatloaf. The next song is maybe
Journey.
I don't know. Some Journey. And then so you bring it down.
And then eventually Aerosmith. Get down. Right.
Yeah. So it's matching and then slowly taking it to the next level. And you can do that easily in 5 or 6 songs because the music syncs with your internal rhythm.
Welcome to the Permission to Heal podcast. I am Marcy Brockman. Together, we will discover what brings us healing, meaning, and true joy. You only need your own permission to begin. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Permission to Heal. I am Marcy Brockman, and I am thrilled that you are here. And really, I say that every time, but I honestly am thrilled that you are here, that you are choosing to spend your time with my guests and me. Today, I have the most wonderful conversation with such a real, authentic, beautiful person, Dr. Bethany Cook. You are just going to love her. She's the author of a book called For What It's Worth, A Perspective on How to Thrive and Survive Parenting Ages 0 to 2. And she wrote this book after having 2 small children, seemingly back to back, and surviving 0 to 2 for both of them, and realizing that we needed, that parents, mothers, parents need help, need resources. They need to know that they're not crazy. They need to have some real in the trenches, I just did this and know it works kind of advice. Plus, she has the added benefit of being a PhD in psychology and being a therapist. So, you know, that's helpful. She has been called an expert for Parade Magazine. No, she has been called in as an expert for Parade Magazine, Today, WGN Morning News, Pure Wow, and more. She is officially a full-time parent of 2. I think she said that they were 5 and 9. I could be wrong. She's a licensed clinical psychologist, a health service psychologist, and a board certified music therapist. Currently, she's working on developing and producing TV shows centered on families and mental health, among other things. The goal of these endeavors are to help others build strong family systems and encourage them to live their truth in order to strengthen their human connections through self-awareness and positive communication. Dr. Bethany is also a freelance writer and provides parenting articles on her own blog at drbethanycook.com. The links are in the show notes. Posts and interacts daily with followers on her Facebook group, A Perspective on Parenting, which I am a member of, and enjoys making fun and engaging content on her TikTok account at Dr. B. Cook. Very cool. So she and her wife and their 2 children live in Chicago, and she is just a delight. And we had a really wonderful conversation. And yeah, I hope that you enjoyed as much as we did. It runs a little long because we chatted a lot and we found that we had so much in common and fed off each other's energy. And it was just really wonderful. Here's the episode. And if you like it, and I'm sure you will, please subscribe, please like, please leave us a wonderful review because I know that you're just going to love it. And share it with your friends and your family, and especially with people you know who are parents or who know kids or who have kids or who are grandparents or who potentially might want to have kids at some point. It's helpful. Or preschool teachers, daycare workers. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the episode. Thank you so much for being here. I love you all. Welcome, Bethany. Dr. Bethany. Dr. Bethany Cook. Let's do that better. Welcome, Dr. Bethany Cook. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. I'm really happy to be here. I'm glad to be invited. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. There's a lot to talk about. I think you have a lot for us to unpack here together. So you're in Chicago.
Yes.
You are from Indiana.
Yes.
Nice. Interesting story. I can't wait to have you get into that. But let's start with our 6 quick questions.
And okay.
We'll see where it goes. Feels like we should do them now.
Let's do it. Let's do it. If you feel it, let's do it.
Let's just do it. Okay. So what 6 words would you use to describe yourself?
I would say raw, real, relatable, energetic, caring, and fun.
Wow. Raw. Was that, that's cool.
Did I do that too many?
No, that was six. That was six.
Was that six? Okay.
You had three R's in the beginning, and I was wondering, ooh, she's going for alliteration. Are they all going to be R's?
I know. I couldn't think of the other ones. Unruly. No, I'm just joking.
It was funny. It was funny. Raw. Yeah. Interesting. I like that. What is your favorite way to spend a day?
You know, after kids, I try to think, what would my ideal day be? And even before kids, my ideal day is sitting in a room, being in my bedroom, the sunshine coming in just enough to warm you up. I want some snacks beside me, maybe some, you know, Doritos or whatever, and some water. And I want to just read. I want to get lost in a book for the entire day in my bed with the sunshine, like a cat. Like, I miss those days because I didn't realize just how much I did that and loved it. And now I can't because I have kids as often. Yeah.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And I might come up with some other random answer to that question. But to me, reading something I'm enjoying in bed is, to me, is, I know this is going to sound sacrilege and my husband's going to roll his eyes when he listens to this, but it's better than sitting on the beach in Aruba. You know,
there you go. I agree.
There's it's safe. It's cozy. Yep. Ain't nothing going to happen to you that you don't want to happen to you.
That's right. And you can go wherever you want in the story. You follow the book.
To travel without moving an inch. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Heaven.
My favorite.
Heaven. I think I'm going to do that later. Although I'm reading so much. I'm an English teacher by day. Okay. And it's the end of the marking period. So there's been a ton of reading and a ton of grading and a ton of like scrutinizing little numbers in a column and getting them to match other scrutinized numbers in columns on computers. And I'm, you know, trying to keep up with the research for the podcast guests. And I'm like reading books and like all of this stuff. And,
oh my gosh.
And I literally feel like my eye muscles are yelling at me. You know, and I love to read. So that's the thing I do to relax.
I write
to relax. I draw or paint to relax, all vision. Mm-hmm. Or I play. I have this one video game that I like and I play that. But it's all vision. Like I need to do something.
You need to listen to music. That's my master's and bachelor's are music therapy. So you need to get some headphones, close your eyes, get some music going.
That's the thing, isn't it? I was sitting in the car yesterday with my husband. He was driving. Well, we were going to his brother-in-law's house. I was driving, and whoever is the driver gets to determine what everyone listens to. That's our deal.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I'm in the middle of listening to an audiobook. And to me, when I'm driving, it's audiobooks, it's podcasts, it's, you know, all sorts of things, mental health and enjoyment and stuff like that. It sounds horrible, but I forgot about music.
Yeah. That's not horrible.
I forgot it was a thing, you know, right? Like I was so into the talk stuff while I was listening that I forgot. So he was driving on the way home and he said, I can't listen to that book that you're listening to. I just can't. I'm like, that's fine. He listened to a random half hour in the middle of it. So he said, put on that playlist you made me that we hadn't played on in a long time. And I found I was singing and bopping along and I was in a better mood and I wasn't yawning as much. Mm-hmm. And I was like, my God, music's awesome.
There's so much. We could have a whole nother podcast about music. Okay. Like there's so much benefit to it and things to learn about it. But yes, that's why that music is like your head was bobbing. I'll just one little thing I'll tell you about music. So when you listen to music, what it does is it syncs your internal rhythms and vibrations. So you're bobbing to the music, right? Your whole body's in focus and it releases stress and it allows your physical energy to match an external energy, which then allows for a physical validation, if you will, at an energy level, which is calming. So music's amazing.
That's awesome. It's very cool. I was listening to you explained something similar to that on another podcast. And you were talking about music matching the energy. You gave the example of somebody who was really angry getting in the car and putting on loud music.
Yes.
Is it more beneficial if you're in an angry mood or in a, you know, high energy mood to put high energy music on versus putting something calming on?
It is the point of it. And I'll tell you why. So there's a principle called the ISO principle. And it's a law of physics that states that if you put two grandfather clocks in a room and the pendulums are swinging at different speeds and different times, that over time, the kinesthetic energy will sync those two pendulums. So they'll be in sync. Okay. When our body is feeling a certain way, if we want, like, let's say an adolescence, like we often remember, you know, teenage years, your puberty, there's a lot of energy happening within the body and you're right. maybe vibrating at this speed. And then your mom's putting on Yanni and you're vibrating at this speed. These energy levels don't
it's
mix.
It's going to aggravate you more than anything else.
Boom. That's it. It winds you up. So imagine being really mad. You get in the car, you slam the door and you turn on, I don't know, Yanni or Kenny G. If you put on the opposite, what it does is it actually irritates you even more. You're just like, wow. It's like telling somebody you had a really crappy day. Yeah. And then the person, the crappy day, they go, oh, well, that's, let me tell you about my day. And they just totally invalidate your experience. So the point is to match the energy and then slowly bring it down. So you match it with AC/DC. The next song maybe is Meatloaf. The next song is maybe
Journey.
I don't know. So yeah, Journey. And then
you
bring it down.
And then eventually
Aerosmith.
Get down. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's matching and then slowly taking it to the next level. And you can do that easily in 5 or 6 songs because the music syncs with your internal rhythm. You can't fight it. And if you are consciously thinking, listening to the music and allowing the music to do the heavy lifting, it is so easy to go from one mood state to another. And
can you the opposite? Can you start in a low mood, low energy and bring yourself up slowly?
Totally. Yep. Absolutely. It works always for any type of emotional shift. And the real, I guess the more difficult aspect of this is why, you know, we can't just go and make a CD that says, be happy to mad. You're happy to mad music is going to be different than mine. And it's going to be different from somebody else's. So it has to be individualized. So you have
to make your own playlists. Yeah.
Yes. But you do it when you're not in that mental state. You think about what music really do I really love when I'm mad? And maybe listen to a few and go, yes, that's going to be it. And then you build your playlist from there. So you have to do it before. It's that preventative medicine. I'm all about preventative. Right. So let's have 5 or 6 playlists that you need when you're in that mood, click, boom, go. And you're set and you even have music that you like. And that's a really big factor that you enjoy the music that you're listening to you wanted to shift your mood.
Excellent. That's very cool. Yeah, I had kids, all my students today were writing essays. It was quiet work period. Everyone has stuff to do tonight. I mean, stuff due tonight. Let's just take the class period to do that. And I put on some lo-fi, like new agey hip hop kind of no words. And I think we all got into a nice flow.
Yeah, but that does help. And it also, when you have music and you're in a group, what you can evoke is a group think or group sensation. You know, you're at a basketball game, you don't care about basketball, let's say, and then suddenly everybody's on their feet cheering. You're on your feet before you know it. It's group think. You no longer think on your own. You're part of the bigger mass. And so music has that ability to change the energy as well within a contained room. You know, I mean, of course, if you're at a Dell concert, you're going to feel that whether the room is contained or not.
Sure.
She's amazing. But that's the concept behind it.
Interesting. Wow. Well, okay. We had a little deviation, but I love that. That's awesome.
Okay, cool.
Okay. Question number 3. What is your favorite childhood memory?
You know, my dad and I used to walk in the woods behind our house for hours. And he let me, I'd pretend I was a Native American. I'd pretend I was, you know, a pirate. I'd pretend I was whatever. And we would just go for long walks in the woods and I'd lose myself in imagination and imaginative play. And he just kind of made sure I was safe, got home, wasn't necessarily directly involved in it. And just really let me be myself. And that I think that I felt a lot of freedom in that
I
look back.
So he didn't pretend to be the Native American with you. He just,
sometimes he would bring his machete. He was so funny. I love my dad. He's since has passed, but he lived his whole life undiagnosed Asperger's. And so he didn't really pick up a lot on sometimes social cues, what, you know, people are supposed to do. Dads do this and kids do this. He didn't pick up on all of that, which was great for me because I was such a not in the box kind of kid. And sometimes he'd take his machete and we'd pretend we're going tracking something. So he did play with me in that way. And we would just have fun. We would just really have a nice time.
Sounds fabulous. That's great. What is your favorite meal?
Oh my God. I love tacos. It's so cliche. I love tacos. I love tacos. I love tacos. Any kind of taco.
Hard shell, soft shell, doesn't matter.
You know, it doesn't matter. It honestly doesn't. Anything Mexican, just give it to me. I love it.
Okay. There you go.
That's my meal.
That's your meal. What is one piece of advice you would like to give your younger self?
When I was little, I thought that because somebody was older than me or they were an adult, that they knew everything.
Oh, I think we all thought that.
Right. So if I'm going back to tell my younger self, I'm saying, listen, they do not know. They know shit about shit about shit. Okay. And don't listen to anything they say.
We're just tall kids with bills to pay.
Right. And I didn't even realize that for such a long time. And then, you know, when you have that, you're working in like an office setting or you're working and you're just like, oh my God, this is like, that kid could have been that kid in high school. And that person fits that role. And we all have, you know, roles we fit into, whatever. Sometimes we can shift from those, but I'm just like, oh my God, they're just grown ups. It's just grown up like a school. So, but I used to put a lot of, because I wasn't a typical child, I was unruly and I had lots of dreams and passion and energy.
That's it would have been nice. And you being energetic.
I know. Close your eyes and try really hard. They need to rest anyways, right? They're tired. So, but I think that just telling yourself, and it's not about you, it's about them. Those are the two things. Number one, adults are just grown up kids most of the time, trying to undo their childhood trauma, which is what we're all trying to do. And then be able to live somewhat of an adult life in a healthy mental state, right? And then the other one is, it is not about you. Like and it took me a long time to realize that. And I believe that the only reason that I really can like say that with such, it is not about you, is because I feel sometimes I'm the wizard behind the screen. So on social media, I see what everybody puts out there. And I love that people feel safe with me to PM me behind that shield and say, hey, by the way, do you have a good book on divorce for my kid, when they just posted a family picture, right? So it's
curated lives of social media.
Right. But even if it's not social media, like a lot of times when people are having a bad day or something's going on and they overreact to you, or you feel like, wow, that was a strong response.
Sure.
It's because that individual is more than likely triggered, and it's not about you. Mm-hmm. So don't take it personally and just keep moving on. And so those are the two things that I'd probably say.
That's excellent. I keep coming back to lately, I don't know if you've watched the television show Ted Lasso on.
No, I haven't seen that.
My God, I heard Brene Brown gushing and she interviewed half the cast, and everywhere I turn seems to be Ted Lasso, Ted Lasso, Ted Lasso. Anyway, so I watched both seasons 3 times.
Oh my gosh, I got to watch this now. Lord.
It is so good. It is so good. But the one thing that he says, I said it to my class today and it totally made sense. He said the animal with the shortest memory is a goldfish. And so I had a kid squabbling, you know, she's touching me. You know, like they acted like 5-year-olds and they're 16, you know. And I said, just be a goldfish.
Ah,
they got it, you know.
Nice.
Like,
yeah.
It's not about you. It's not
Get
a big
over it.
Thing.
Yeah.
The world's going to keep spinning. The earth's not going to swallow you up. In 5 minutes, it's not going to matter. So be a goldfish. Forget it.
That's great.
I just love
that. Be a goldfish.
Be a goldfish.
Be a goldfish.
Okay, last question. What is one thing you would most like to change about the world?
Well, I kind of hinted on it a little bit ago when I mentioned something about undoing our childhood trauma.
Yes.
What I would love to do for the world is to teach everyone, parents, not even parents, because the thing is, kids don't grow up with just parents. They go out into the world and they have teachers and they have aunts and uncles and they have people at the grocery store. You don't have to have kids to parent, help parent a generation. So it is my goal.
It's a village, you know.
Yes, absolutely. It is my goal that I inspire a generation of humans to look at children in a different way, to be able to see them and to provide a structure and a foundation that is going to build their neurocognitive pathways in positive ways, that's going to validate their lived experiences, that stops all this gaslighting bullshit that parents do. Oh, you're fine. Get up. How do you know they're fine? How about, are you okay to get up? Don't just assume that, because that teaches children that we can't trust ourselves, that what we feel isn't real. And then we spend our entire life undoing all of it. And I want people to break that. I am a trauma toxic pattern breaker. It stops with me and my kids. And, you know, and so that's
why
my
I like
goal.
You. I that's me too. I worked my whole entire life to get rid of all of the toxic template bullshit that I inherited from my mother, who was an undiagnosed self-medicated bipolar and wound up dead because of an opiate addiction that she used to numb out all the shit that she couldn't deal with.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So nothing she ever tried to do for herself worked. And eventually, about 18 months before she died, I had to excommunicate her from my life because I couldn't.
It has to happen sometimes.
I couldn't. I probably would have suffered through the toxicity of her bullshit forever, but it started to affect my kids.
That's where
and
it stops.
They were afraid of her. And she came into my house and spewed all of this venomous bullshit in my living room, and I threw her and my stepfather out. My kids went crying into my daughter's bedroom and locked the door in terror, and I threw them out. And I never had another conversation with my mother ever again. I wrote her a very long letter explaining what was going on, and you have two choices.
Mm-hmm.
You can either go with me to an inpatient addiction treatment counseling center and go through the entire program and get yourself clean and learn about your shit, and I will be there with you every single step of the way. If you choose not to do that, you will never see us again.
Right.
And she
that's
said,
so hard.
And she's like, what are you, a fucking doctor? You don't know how to do anything. You're a stupid English teacher. You can't tell me what to do.
Oh,
that's
my
what
God.
She said on my answering machine, because I wouldn't pick up the phone because I knew that that's what was going to happen. But
right.
You know,
oh,
I had to
God.
Say what I needed to say. So I FedExed her this long letter so she couldn't say she didn't get it.
Right. Yeah. So, make sure she signed for it. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So I have spent pretty much every single day since then, and then since her death, trying to figure out how to heal myself and how to keep that negative bullshit from, I'm cursing a lot
your
today.
Kids.
Sorry, listeners. Yeah. To protect my kids. And
it's me.
And it's you.
I like to cuss. I love to cuss. And you dropped the S word first. I was like,
okay, good. Well, we got New York and Chicago here. You know, it's not
We talk big. We're big people. We're big talkers. What are we going to say? Exactly. I am really sorry about that experience, but what a warrior you are to do that for yourself, for your children. And it wasn't just for your children. You did that for your inner child.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then I do a lot of meditation. I do a lot of journal writing. I wrote a memoir, and I do a lot of art therapy. Art therapy is huge for me. And I, during
Did you know that? Go ahead. I'm so sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
I just got excited when you said you did all this creative stuff, because creativity actually heals trauma.
Yeah, absolutely.
On a molecular level. I love that. So you've been doing the work. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've been in therapy for like 20 some odd years, but yeah. But,
me too.
But the most significant strides have come through the creation of artwork for me.
Yes.
Somewhat writing. Yes. Obviously, you know, figuring out patterns and so on, and reading books from notable psychologists and so on that have been through this shit and have seen their patients do all of this. That helps a lot. But my own internal reprogramming, the reparenting of little Marcy, all came through painting.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it for that reason. I've just have always been a creator. And and so after my mom died, I was trying to figure out, like, I got to do something.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do. I'm like, I'm going to start painting again, because it had been quite a few years since I had allowed myself the time to do that. And as I was sitting there focusing on color and brushstrokes, I was really figuring everything else out.
Right.
And it was amazing. And I had a moment, and I don't know if it was during meditation or if it was during a painting session, but I had like an image, almost like I was watching a video of me entering my childhood bedroom and sitting on the floor next to like 6-year-old Marcy and putting my arm around her and hugging her and telling her it's all going to be okay, that she doesn't have to be afraid. No one's, you know, she's not crazy. You know, like the mismatch between what was going on inside and going on outside. She shouldn't trust the mismatch, because what she had going on inside was what was really happening. And I felt like liberated, like tons of earth just lifted off of me. It was
beautiful.
Quite amazing.
Yeah.
But I don't think, you know, even with all of that, and I went to a psychic, which was uncharacteristic of me, but helped a ton. I still don't think that I'm done. I don't think anybody's ever done.
You're never really done. No.
I think that, you know, you get to a certain point where you're like, all right, okay with that for now. Let's work on this over here. This pile. This pile that's been collecting dust needs a little attention.
Right. Right.
You know, just sort of move around your world. But
yeah. I always see life, you know, everybody talks about life as linear. Like we're on this path. And I've always seen life as a spiral staircase going
Holy
up.
Holy shit, me too.
Well, there you go. That's why you revisit shit. You might have like the mothers right here, but as you go around, you'll revisit it. And every time you get
like
better.
A double helix, like a DNA. Yes. That's how I've always described it. And I can see every year of my life around here where January is and where July is. Yep. And it just.
That's how I see it as well. Yeah.
I have never met another person who saw it that way before.
Wow.
Bethany, soul sisters, man.
Hug, hug.
Wow.
I know. But isn't that such a better way to look at life? Because then you don't go, shit, I thought I already dealt with this. I thought that was way back behind me. And here it is again. What's wrong with me? It's not about you.
No.
It's a cycle. It's going up.
It's a cycle.
You're going to revisit stuff. And each time you revisit it, you deal with it a little bit more. And you get better and you heal from it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Cool. Oh my God, that's my goal. To help families so that kids don't have to do what we're talking about.
That's awesome.
Or if they do,
well, there'll
a
be other
bit.
Things. You know, let them heal from other things, not the same intergenerational shit that's been handed down for four generations, right?
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow, I'm so energized. It's so exciting.
Yay!
Okay, so let's go more, to Bethany. Where are my questions?
Okay.
Here are my questions.
Where are your questions? What are your questions?
I don't know. I'm like, well, jumbled now. I'm like,
oh, she's like,
helix.
I'm
like, my brain.
Helixes.
Is like,
that's it.
So excited. So excited. Okay. So you're from Indiana. You're from a religious family. They were Mormons, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I read somewhere that you call yourself an excommunicated Mormon. I got to know more about this. What?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Well, I call myself that because I am officially an excommunicated Mormon.
Okay.
So here's the irony. I was raised from 7 in the Mormon church in Indiana. So it wasn't like in Utah where everybody's Mormon. So I was in a small rural town. Of course, there's like 3 families who had most of the kids. They 9 kids, 8 kids. So they was maybe 3 or 4 families, but there was maybe 30 of us in a high school of 2000. Okay. So there's not oodles, but I don't know. I always just like heard the stories about Christ being kind and about being kind to others and don't judge. And I always really embraced that stuff. So I was like the perfect idyllic Mormon, right? In that sense of reflecting the principles and teachings of the church. And so I had a lot of respect for the church. And then, here's the funny thing is the church tells you lots of things. Don't have sex. Don't do this. They never told me. And this is how like sometimes I think black and white think I am, but they never specifically said, if you're a girl, you should not kiss another girl. Nobody told me that. So I'm thinking, okay, it wasn't ingrained, right? So I go off to a private women's college and it could have been a straight, you know, not just a women's college. It just happened to be a women's college. And I met a girl there.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, co-ed. That's the word I was looking for. Thank you. And this girl, like my body just was like, whoa, what is this? Oh my God.
Here she is.
That's it. And I kissed her and she kissed me back. And that began at age 18. I secretly sought out therapy because I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, I'm a Mormon. I'm going to hell. Like I had all this. So I had from 18 until about 28, I was in and out of therapy working on myself in the sense of like, how does this work? Why am I feeling this? Why would God want me to be this way? I went to one Mormon therapist and it was a man. And I'll tell you the advice he gave me. It was really, really good. Wink, wink, laced in sarcasm. So I say to him, you know, I go to these Mormon dances. And I said, the boys just don't like me. I don't have blonde hair. I don't have blue eyes. I'm not petite. I'm a woman. I'm like 5'7", 180 pounds of muscle. I'm proportioned, but like, I'm not. And I said, I don't laugh at their stupid jokes. Like sometimes they're funny. Sometimes they're not. I'm like, I was always one of the guys. Do you know what I mean? That was the other thing. Like they're my friends.
Type of girl. No, me either.
So I told the therapist that and he goes, well, how about this? And the church has tons of social things, right? They want you to meet other Mormons. So I was at like 23 or something. And he's like, well, why don't you go to the social? And this time, if a boy makes a joke, laugh at it. And maybe so you'll get a dance.
So you're supposed to fake the laugh to get the dance?
Yep. That's it.
Sounds like my grandma's dating advice. That's my grandma's dating advice.
Yeah. This was a qualified therapist's advice, like BS. So I left that. This is a lot. I'm going to cut to the chase because I've talked forever about this. So anyways, a lot of therapy gave me the self-awareness, self-esteem to finally go, yeah, this is me. I had one girlfriend that I thought long-term with, the potential for long-term, because up until then it was like, great, I can have sex with chicks and not get pregnant. Yay. You know Woo-hoo! What I mean? Like, and I identify as bisexual. So it wasn't like a one or the other kind of thing to me.
Sure.
And
whoever's and nice then, and makes the cut.
That's right. You make the cut. And I didn't think I needed to tell anybody I was bisexual until I, you know, what if I ended up with a dude? Then why would I make everything, you know, bring that up? So Then I meet my wife when I'm 28, who I'm still married to 14 years later, happily. I can say happily. Thank you. And I respected the church enough to say, you know what? I need to let them know what's going on. So I went to my bishop in Chicago and I told him, and he's like, well, we're going to have a hearing. I'm like, that's fine. Do what you need to do. They sent me a letter in the mail, a formal letter. I had to go to the church. My wife drove me because she thought I was going to be upset. I said, I'm not going to be upset. It's fine. But she drove me and sat in the parking lot. And I went into the church off hours some evening, and it was the bishop, his two counselors, the secretary. And one of the counselors was my friend's husband. Okay. So I'm looking at these people getting ready to judge me. And then the secretary I'd never met, he was the biggest queen I had ever seen. I'm like, what? Is there a camera somewhere? Like, what is going on here?
Irony.
And I just like, I kept looking at him going, what are you doing? But the church has a policy that you can be gay. You can even live with somebody so as long as you don't have sex.
Well, who's going to?
Nice, right?
Who's
right,
gonna
I know. Of course you're going
to
have sex with somebody if you're married. What are you going to lie to the bishop? And anyways, that guy was there too. So
then there's the sin of the lie and all of that. Like
exactly. Thank
that's
you.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's totally ridiculous. So the bishop kept asking me about my testimony with Christ.
Not that we're insulting Mormons. If you're a Mormon listening, we love you.
Yes. I'm not insulting. Like, I did all this out of respect for the church, and I still have great respect for the church and the principles. I do think that there are some flaws that I can now see now that I'm out of that cultish mentality. And I will say that there are some things that need to be reevaluated within the church hardcore. That's another story, right? I'm in the bishop's office. He's telling me I can't, you know, he's questioning my testimony. And I'm just like, dude, I'm not going to change what I'm saying. I love this woman. I'm going to marry her. Do what you need to do.
Right.
So I go sit in the hallway for 30 minutes while they deliberate. I'm like, what are you doing in there? I go back in, I sit down, and they go, okay, well, we're going to have to excommunicate you. You can come to church still though, but you can't have a calling. You can't say prayers openly. You can't take the sacrament, but you can still come.
You can come and just sit mutely in the back.
Yeah. And I was like, no, I don't think so. And then he's like, we'd like to keep your name on our mailing list. And I said, absolutely not. And then at the end, he goes, would you like to say closing prayer? And I'm like, you just excommunicated me and told me I can't.
Told me I couldn't pray.
Right. So I was, but it was like divine intervention from God. I'm not even kidding you. I said yes. And I folded my arms. I even did a TikTok about this. You'll have to scroll back in all my TikToks, but I actually did this whole thing, like a quick one. And it was like somebody was putting words in my mouth. It was like, dear Heavenly Father, please be with these men who feel that they have to judge women and other people in this earthly life, that they have to bear this responsibility of knowing. Like, it was brilliant. And then I just said, amen, goodbye, hasta luego. Don't let the door hit your ass on the way out. And then I like left, walked down the stairs. And it was a similar experience to what you just described about your childhood when you went into your inner. Every step I took down, it was as if cinder blocks were being thrown off my shoulders.
Wow.
And I felt so close to God. I felt so spiritual, and I never thought
you
that
would
happen.
You were living your truth. You were finally authentically Bethany.
And I finally had come clean with the institution that made me who I am, the kind, loving, giving person, the non-judgmental person sat and was judged and kicked out of the very place that created her in some ways. I was just like, see ya.
That's some serious,
I saw a lot of Mormon friends.
Bullshit right there.
I know. That's a semi-long, short version of it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you finally did tell your family, I mean, obviously the church didn't so much like it, but when you right. finally did tell your family, were they accepting, comfortable?
It How was did that mixed. Go? It was mixed. So my mom, dad, and my sister are the only Mormons in my family. Essentially, they converted. So the rest of my extended family are not Mormons, so they don't really care. When I told my dad, he was lovely. I mean, he's, you know, remember Asperger's, and he was yeah. just like, well, my parents were divorced when I was 19. So they'd been separated for quite some time. And he's like, you've always supported me with my life choices and you've always been there for me. So of course I'm going to love you no matter what. And yeah, that was really nice to hear. And then my sister, I told her, she's older than me. She's adopted as well. We're both adopted. And not that that's relevant. I just think it's interesting, right? Genetics, families, they hear stories. So anyways, but she goes, well, because I called her, I said, I'm engaged. And she just goes, well, what does that mean? And I'm like, well, the same thing it would mean if I was engaged to a dude. Okay, congratulations. I don't want to hear anything about the sex. Yuck. I just don't talk to me about the sex. And it was just funny.
Why like would her, you? If you were married to a guy, would you tell your might have a relationship with your sister to talk about the sex?
Maybe. That's not our relationship. Right. So it was funny because we joke about that whole, I'm like, Kirsten, I don't want to hear about your sex with your husband either. Like, it's mutual. Okay. Don't you worry. And my mom was a bit harder. Yeah. So it was a crying on the bed, fear of my loss of my eternal soul, fear that our family wouldn't be eternally together because Mormons, you know how they feel. And so I'm no longer a Mormon. And I think there was some acceptance to my face, but not necessarily full acceptance to peers. And some of it, you know, I'm not blaming my mom for how she responded. Everybody responds how they respond. But I think it's also, you know, I was 16 when she told me her worst nightmare was to have a daughter who was a lesbian. I didn't even know what lesbian was at the time.
Wow.
She would have rather had a daughter get pregnant out of wedlock. And she shares now that, you know, she just didn't know much about it and she felt ignorant to it. And I don't know. But then when your daughter starts to show signs of liking chicks, maybe do some research, you know, so you're not so ignorant.
Well, she was probably well in denial at that point.
Oh, seriously, well in denial. Reading, they like snooped in my room and found love letters I'd written to my first girlfriend, my mom and my sister. So that did not go over well either. But it was, so eventually I think, she's come around. She's accepting. I think she sees my wife as, I mean, the funny thing is, if my wife was a man, I have married the idyllic, like, person. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
So I have the picket fence. I got the two kids, the two dogs, the supportive spouse, you know, like, wonderful I've got life. It all, man. Yeah. And I wouldn't have had it if I had married. I had a couple other proposals and to men, and it just didn't feel right. I just felt deep down that maybe I'm going to cheat on you with a chick because I just don't love you enough in this moment. I don't know.
Right.
Anyways. That was the story.
Yeah, I have a very good friend of mine who got married to a man because her Irish Catholic family mandated that that's how she be.
Yeah.
And she had girlfriends in high school and hid them from her parents
yeah.
and dated and married this guy that she had met in college. And it just wasn't right.
No.
I mean, he was a little shit besides the fact that it just... the gender or the sex did not work for her.
Right.
And
right.
so she got divorced, dated a couple of girls. My parents did not like that at all. And then but it was just dating. So why are they going to get that upset about it? You know,
right,
who
right.
knows if it's going to stick or not.
Exactly.
And then she met the woman of her dreams and she proposed. I don't know. I think she proposed to Anna. I'm not sure. Anyway. And
They're
then there
married.
Was this
They're
big
together.
Wedding and there was this wedding in this in New York City and her parents went and everything was good. And but there was a percentage of their love, approval, judgment, something that was reserved.
Oh, yeah. Know? Oh, yeah, it is. You feel it. It's
we
hard to feel
until a point. And, mm-hmm. and they were here for a few years, the first few years of their marriage. And I think being so close to her family was difficult. And her wife's family's from Australia. And they were like, come, we love you. Let's celebrate every freaking second of our lives.
Yes.
You're both fabulous. So they're like, stay where we're not
we're
really
here.
Accepted or go where we're fully accepted. So they were like, we're gone.
Bye. Yeah.
So, yeah. So now they built themselves a house, have two wonderful daughters, with this big extended family that they adore, and they're happy, happier than they ever thought they would be.
It's beautiful. It's because they're living their truth.
Exactly.
And that goes back to the whole, my whole life vision, life goal. I want people to learn from my example, my mistakes. I want people to learn from other people's examples and mistakes. And I want everybody to come together so we can live in harmony with differences and tolerate differences and not take that shit personally.
Non-judgment.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's my goal.
I think it's a great goal. How do you help your patients, clients? What do you call them?
Clients, usually.
Clients. Figure out how to find their authenticity if they've been running from it or chasing it down to no avail for years. Like, what advice do you give them? Where do they start?
The first thing that I do that I don't think is advice, that the first thing that popped into my head is that I validate their lived experience. I'm usually the very first person in somebody's life that whatever they say, I validate, I accept. It's okay. You're not crazy. Like, let's look at this. And so I allow a level of safety. And I think it's really hard for individuals to feel safe with somebody, to stop long enough to really open up and explore who they are. Because during our adolescence, many times it's, do I want to put this hat on? Or do I want to put this hat on? Am I a theater geek? Am I a drama nerd? Am I a jock?
Sure.
What is it that I am? And so
teenagers like to label things.
Yes. Well, all of us like labels. I mean, there's a whole thing I can talk about why our brain works that way. But to answer the question, it is finding somebody that you can, you would say to them, listen, I want to really kind of figure out who I am. Can you be the person to help me navigate that? Because when you are trying to figure that out, you need somebody to say stuff to that may sound crazy, right? Like, clients will tell me something and they're really hesitant to say, wow, I cheated on my boyfriend, or just something like, I cheated on my boyfriend and I didn't feel guilty about it. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. They don't want to share that I didn't feel guilty. You don't always have to feel guilty if you cheat. Let's talk about it. Why did you not feel guilty? There's no judgment. And so to have somebody that you can be your whole self with, it's like the BFF, you know, the bestie. And then if you get a therapist, they actually that has some, hopefully some knowledge and some of theory. Right. Theory and this works, this doesn't work, that they can then help guide you to identify who it is that you are. But the first thing that I would say to you is you have to stop worrying what other people think. Mm-hmm. You will never find your authentic self or your authentic voice when you're worried about what everybody else thinks. And many of us come from homes where we have been people pleasers. And so I know, me too. And so when we people please, we're uncomfortable if somebody doesn't like us. Right. I was 18 years old before I realized people didn't like me, because I had ADHD and I'm just all over the place, that I wasn't slowing down enough to see maybe the eye rolls or whatever. But in some ways I was really lucky because it didn't impact my self-esteem. Right. I thought everybody loved me. How crazy I was. And
yeah, I knew people didn't like me, or, you know, I mean, obviously I had some friends, you know, but they're when you find somebody who doesn't like you. It was a long time before I was able to say, I don't care if I'm not everyone's cup of tea. In fact, I'm glad I'm not everyone's cup of tea. You know?
Right. Yeah. And it took me a while before I had to say, it's okay if people don't like you.
Yeah.
You don't have to please everybody.
I don't like everyone. So.
Right. Exactly. And that, I think that's the thing. And so one of the first steps to becoming your authentic self is to say, I have to stop caring about what other people think. And I really have to figure out what it is that I like. So often we become friends with other people. And yes, there needs to be some often shared hobbies or shared passions, right? But many times I see a lot in couple relationships where the girl will often just give up everything and do whatever the boy wants. They're all about karate now, or they're all about cars. And so if you have a few dating experiences like that, and then you have a few friends that you have adapted and shifted yourself so you can fit in and be accepted. We all want to be accepted. So to somebody who says they don't want to be, that's bullshit. I want to be accepted. I don't have to be accepted though. I'm happy to be single. You know, so I think being able to come to a place where you can just go, I don't give a shit, enough that you can at least be your true self. And so then you have to figure out who you are, right? You've been with all these people and you've shape shifted so much that, what do I fucking like? And many times I'll say to somebody, I want you to think back to when you were a child, like tween, before even the tween years. And sometimes that's where you reconnect to those, what did I like about life? But if those first 10 years of your life were all trauma, avoiding mom or dad or abuse of any kind, it's really hard to know what it is that you like.
Yeah. I went back when I was reading my book, I went back to the journals that I've been keeping since 1983 and I read all of them. And there was a whole shit ton of stuff that I had no recollection of. I was getting all the Twitter about these things and who the hell is Carla? I don't even know who Carla is. You know, like, no idea. I called my best friend from high school and I'm like, we were really mad about this girl named Carla in 1985. Do you remember what this was? And she's like, no, no clue.
Oh my God, it's hilarious.
It's so funny. But
wherever you are, Carla, we're over it.
Yeah, we're done with you, Carla. I forgot what I was going to say.
You're talking about people not caring what other people think.
Oh, yeah, reading your journals. I was reading my journals and I was starting to figure out, like, when I was in my early 20s and I was single and I was looking for someone significantly important and good and kind to date, my stepmother had me create a list of all the qualities that I was looking for in a man. Okay. And a subset list of deal breakers.
Oh.
Things that I would not compromise on.
Right.
And wouldn't you know, young 20-something Marcy compromised on all the things she wouldn't compromise on.
Oh, no.
Right?
No. Oh, no.
So, long story short, I get married. I have two kids. I get divorced. And then between that divorce and getting remarried to my current amazing, wonderful husband, Michael, I was single for 10 years. Mm. And I dated like it was my job. I was on every dating website.
Oh my God.
And I went through that same, I was using that same list from when I was in my early 20s as a list to judge or evaluate potential dates. And what I realized was A, in my 40s, my priorities are not the same as they were when I was 20.
Right.
But that what I was doing in my 40s was the same as what I was doing in my 20s. So as I was chatting online or sitting across the dinner table from some new prospective bachelor, I was simultaneously trying to carry on a conversation and predict what this stranger wanted me to be so he would like
me. Right. Yes, right? Right? Oh.
So I was so less interested in whether I liked him or whether I liked myself with him, which is the most important question. Mm-hmm. And I was more interested in trying to figure out what this total stranger wanted from the date.
Right.
And it took me years of repeating this pattern, you know, wind up like dating in a semi-monogamous or committed relationship with the guy for a few months or a year or whatever. And I'm not me. I'm compromising on things. My boundaries are shot. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I don't feel like myself. I'm drowning. And I'm like, eventually I just said, you know what? Forget it. I'm done. Yeah. I'm going to date myself. Fuck all these men. Screw
beautiful.
Them.
Yeah.
And I went back to the art. I went back to the writing. I went and if I wanted to go see a band at a bar, I went by myself. If I wanted to go to a movie, I did it by myself. If I
love it,
you know, whatever. And then I created a new list of the things that counted, that mattered to me as a 45-year-old single mom, two kids, three jobs, and a mortgage. Like, what is important to me?
Right.
And
what am I looking for?
And then I started dating guys that only fit those categories. And I got rid of all the other things like height and skin color and religion and ethnicity and all that other bullshit that means nothing. And my therapist said that I was dating the UN, but they were all well-educated, you know, responsible adults. But yes, the UN.
Oh my God. I have to pause you because I always have told people that I used to date the Benetton magazine.
Oh, there you go. Same thing.
Boys, girls, colors, whatever. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh, girl.
Exactly. And then I had the epiphany which was, it doesn't matter if they like me. I walked in empty-handed. If I walk out empty-handed, there's no loss there.
Right.
What matters is whether I like them and I want to waste another meal or another hour or another drink or another cup of coffee on them. Exactly. And if the answer is no, I leave. That's it.
Yep.
You know.
Mine was if I would rather be home reading by myself. Exactly. That was my, well, I'm on a date. I'm like, would I rather be reading? We're not going out again. Yeah.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. But it was that whole process that really helped me figure out who I was and what my priorities were as a grown-up, as someone who was nearing midlife and was starting to try to figure her shit out, you know?
Yeah.
And at the same time dealing with childhood, unresolved childhood trauma from my mom and all that other.
Oh my gosh, I know, right? Jeez Louise. Okay. Right by fire.
So you wrote a book. Let's move this along a little. You wrote a book called For What It's Worth, A Perspective on How to Thrive and Survive Parenting Ages 0 to 2.
Yes.
I think that we needed this book. I think that there's a lot of parenting advice out there for teenagers and a lot of stuff about like elementary school age kids. But I think when both my babies were born, the entirety of the advice that I got from the pediatrician was your job is to feed them and keep them from killing themselves.
Yeah, that's about it.
Go home.
Right. Or it's advice from white men who've never been a mother and stayed home. And like, what the fuck do they know about it? You know, nothing.
Right.
So,
Right. When you feel like everything that you wear is covered in urine and poop, that you haven't showered in days, had an intelligent conversation with a human being, and you feel like if you read one more picture book or have one more temper tantrum that you have to, you're going to freaking go ballistic.
Yes. Know? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So tell us about the book. Tell us where it came from. You know, tell us.
Tell you. Okay. So my son was probably 2 months old and I was just having a day going, what is this parenting bullshit? Right. Because
is he the oldest of the two or the youngest?
He is. He's the oldest. Yeah. The kids are 19 months apart. And, you know, I thought I had the gold resume for parenting. I was raised Mormon. I was labeled the baby whisperer at church because babies would just fall asleep on me because my energy is chill. That's why. And like I need nappies, I need kids. I just like, I have a doctorate in behavior, you know, psychology. Right. Like this should be a slam dunk. And I decided to stay home full time and quit my job. This is my full time gig. And I started to just go, what is going on with me? Like when people would say, oh, so when are you going back to work? Or are you just a stay at home mom? And I'm just like,
that just is such bullshit.
I hate that word.
Just should be removed out of the dictionary.
Right. Are you a stay-at-home mom?
It's so judgmental.
It's so judgy. And it made me reflect on everything. And like, I was feeling, as I sat with my newborn, I'm feeling that the world is passing me by, that I'm not going to be valid in whenever time I come back to the workforce, that I should be giving my baby to a daycare to take care of so I can still be a productive citizen. And I was just like, chill the fuck out, Bethany.
There's the Christian Puritan work ethic that is still rotting our souls. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And then I reflected on a client of mine who was, I think she was 15, had a baby, was court ordered to come to therapy because she held her 2-month-old by her feet upside down out of a 2-story window, threatening to drop the baby when the baby's daddy said, I want to break up with you.
No.
So the child was obviously custody was given to this my client's mother, and she was ordered to come to therapy. This is a 15-year-old teenage girl who's been raised in a system of abuse, who's in the West Side ghetto of Chicago, who like, and I thought of her in these early stages with my child, and I thought, how is she supposed to know what to do when every book she reads says, you're supposed to do this and you're supposed to do that. And there, even if she could, there's no way she's going to be able to get out of that.
So I said, I have to, for her. Yeah.
Right. I had to write a book that was relatable to everybody. And it was for this girl. She was always in the back of my mind as I wrote this book because I wanted her to be able to pick it up, read it, and understand it. Mm-hmm. And so I took out probably 150 cuss words. So it was cathartic when I wrote the book as well. Yeah. Because my daughter was 2, and I was like, I got to get this book out because I wanted to live it 0 to 2. I lived it and then I wrote about it. And my long-term plan was to have a series 0 to 2. Yeah, I lived it twice, but they were 19 months apart. So I got no break. So nice. I got pregnant. And how lesbians oops into a pregnancy that close. This is in is of its own story, but it happened.
Wow,
it was in a hospital
that's
room.
True. I wasn't even thinking that. It's not like your wife has loose sperm running around.
Right, right. That's just expensive. Damn. And so it was, so that was kind of what spurned it. And plus I was saying to myself, what that whole just to stay at home mom was in my head the whole time and I couldn't get it out. And I thought, well, if I write a book while I'm home with 2 kids under the age of 2, that should prove to the world that I'm valuable. That should prove to everybody that I can do this. I'll show them I'm not just a stay at home mom. When that in and of itself is the ideal job. If we want to change the way we raise our children, somebody has to stay home. Yeah. I don't give a shit if it's you or your husband. There needs to be our wife or whatever.
Right.
The person you choose to parent with, you have to
grandparent,
have a
the uncle,
plan.
Somebody.
Yes.
Who is
whoever
there
is
as
helping
another
you.
Adult. Yeah.
Yes. We need a team. And then the book was kind of inspired by that. The very first chapter is why do you want to be a parent? Because I've heard so many times from people, I never even want to be a mom. I still don't like my kids. They're 25. Like I didn't like being a mom. I did it because society said to do it. I did it because my church said you had to do it. I did it because my husband expected it.
I did it because it was an accident. Right.
Yeah. I didn't even know it was a choice. So many women are like, I didn't know it was a choice. And if you do choose to not have children as a woman, you're judged. Holy shit. Are you judged?
Yeah. Oh,
it's getting better, but you are judged negatively.
Yeah, my 20-year-old daughter does not want to have children. And she may change her mind. She might not change her mind, but it's her uterus. Right. Do what you want with it.
That's exactly right.
And my father just doesn't understand that. You know, like, of course she wants kids. She'll meet a guy. Eventually she'll want kids. And I'm like, you can't answer that question.
Right.
You don't know what she's gone through from her perspective to make her not want to have kids.
That's right.
And what she wants from her future that she might not want to fit kids in. That's up to her.
Or she could fucking do a whole career and then become a foster parent. And then adopt a kid, a teenager. There's so many teenagers out there who need a home.
Absolutely.
Like, man, you know, I'm adopted, so I'm all about that too. But it's about, I don't know, finding, the book is about, I was hoping to let people also find their own strengths and see that this expert, this person who should have it all together. I have a chapter on sex drive. The tank is on empty, but I appreciate the wax job. Like,
right.
You know, guess what, guys and ladies, we're not horny when we're fucking tired of all day of doing whatever. We are just, we're done.
Especially when you're breastfeeding.
Oh my
and
God.
You're
covered
boobs
in urine. Are sensitive. Yes. You're
and
just
the
over ca- it.
And the you're just being hung on, hanged
just
on,
being
hung
touched.
On
yeah.
all the time
yeah.
by little
yeah.
sticky jelly hands. No.
Yes. Yeah. yeah. And so the chapter
that
just about,
itself
you know,
is a birth control.
I know, right? I know. So like the book is kind of in 3 chunks. And the first of it is literally focused on 0 to 2. Like, this is my opinion on food, naps. I have like 4 chapters on sleep, baby sleep, nighttime sleep, parents' lack of sleep, and then bedroom routine. It's all important. Every chapter is about 5. I have the book on Audible as well. And so it's about 5 to 15 minutes per chapter to listen to. Mm-hmm. And you know, nobody has time for lots. So I didn't want to bog people down with a lot of like theory. And so it's funny. I share my own experiences. I talk about sleep training, my approach, my view on it. I'm adopted, as I've said several times in here, but my daughter, it's interesting because she's very much temperament plays a lot into who we are. And we picked a donor who has the same exact same temperament as my wife. And my son is a mini her. Like, they have the same temperament. It's awesome to see. And then my daughter is a mini me with blonde hair and blue eyes, because I guess donor dad had some seriously strong recessive traits. But my daughter does things that I'm just like, is that encoded on your DNA? Is that some trauma that I haven't undone yet? Is why you're responding that way? Because I was abused the first 9 months of my life. I lived with bio mom, bio dad, bio mom, bio grandma, bio aunt, 7 foster homes. I was adopted, returned.
Whoa.
And then my parents got me when I was 9 months old.
All of that in 9 months?
Nine months.
Holy shit, Bethany.
Right? So when my child was doing similar things that I was told that I did, I'm thinking, there's no, why? Are we undoing the DNA? Are we, what is going on here? So the book, I do a little bit of, because my wife, she wouldn't let anybody hold her but me. She came out, she had pooped, so she had that meconium in her, so they had to suction her. So that's one thing where like, well, maybe she didn't get me right away, but like she wouldn't let my wife really hold her, love on her for a year.
Wow.
She was a parasite hanging on me for a year, my child, because I also believe that you give a baby what they need.
Yeah.
Not what you need, not what you think they need, what they need.
Yeah.
And they're going to be fine.
Yeah.
She wouldn't know that she lived on me for a year.
Making them sleep in another room or don't pick them up because you're going to spoil them.
You cannot spoil a baby. No, oh my God.
I wore my daughter in one of those papoose things.
Yeah.
For like a year and a half, killed my back, but she didn't want to be anywhere but here.
Yep. Yeah. And mine too. So you do it. You do it.
That's it.
You sacrifice. What is it? Like,
right now she's 20.
She's not going to want to be
carried. She'd go back there. You know,
I know. No, but she knows that she's loved. The thing is, the first year you are laying a foundation of trust, of love, of responding to every little need that they, every whim, every need, you have to be there. And if they believe that somebody's going to be there, then they feel safe enough that when they become toddlers, the next book would be 3 to 5, if I ever write that book. But that's about exploring. That's about, they're not going to do that if they don't have a, if they've been left in the room to cry.
They need to feel safe in order to risk the thing that they want to try. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So the first chunk of the book is about that. The second chunk of the book is talking about just don't like not comparing. I think the sex drive chapter's in there, but the Duchess of Cambridge does it. And I was talking about how we all have cognitive distortions. And when we parent and we compare ourselves to other people, it just doesn't work as parents. And so I have a whole chapter on that. I have a whole chapter on diversity in parenting. I have a whole chapter on privilege in parenting. And just, it's just to make people think. It's to make people open their hearts to other parents. Because sometimes we're so judgy and we're so pigeonholed and boxed in. And the book writing, it was cathartic as well. You know, I took out 150 cuss words so it wouldn't offend certain people. I did leave a few in. Yeah, right. And real life. I mean, come on. Who's not going to have it not cuss when a baby's around?
Of course. Of course. Of course. I remember years ago, I had a friend who we had our kids at like almost exactly the same time, same ages. And my youngest, my daughter, was crying a lot. And her oldest, who was 3 years older, she looked at me and she's just like, well, you wanted that baby.
I did. I don't know if I signed up for crying.
I still do, but you know, she's just crying right now. It was just the way, it was funny. She like read the look on my face.
It was you wanted it.
But you know, like even those of us, and I know based on what I've read about you, that you're exactly like me in that from a very, very young age, you pictured yourself a mother before you pictured yourself being anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you have, it's still freaking hard.
Oh, for sure. I love being a mom and it's the hardest job. I remember.
Yeah. The hardest job you'll ever love.
Totally. Totally. And I was probably in my early 20s. And my mom's just, you know, when are we going to have grandbabies and this and this? And I'm like, I'll give you a kid in 9 months. I'm not raising it if that's what you want. But like, stop asking me. But it was this idea that, and I said to her, I am too selfish right now. I need me time. And when I'm a little bit less selfish, I will get married. If I find somebody. And then when I'm ready to just put, I've done what I need to do for a minute and put all my other stuff on hold, not that we put it on hold, because that's also the wrong thing as mothers to think that our life is only our children, but young kids need that level of, you don't have a life when they're little. And if you give it, then you will get a life much earlier as they grow, because you're going to lay that foundation. But it was about, I'm going to be selfish now. And so I had my kids. I said, I'm ready to be less selfish. And then I said, we can have kids. But it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. And once they're out of that, you know, newborn infant stage and they don't need you as vigilantly, then you can start to remember who you were and what you like and what's going on.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, what is that? I forget the psychologist who said this quote that I'm thinking of that I'm totally going to ruin. But something like the worst thing that could happen to a child is for their parents' life to be unlived. Something like that.
Mm. You know? Okay.
you know.
Yeah, that so, they live through their child instead of the parent actually living their own life.
Right. And then it's a whole host of problems.
You know, oh my God, you're living through your kids? No, that's not good either. There is a balance, but there has to be some honest recognition that when you have a very young child, it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of sacrifice. If you do it, I mean, right, what's right? Everybody has a little bit different right. That's fine. But I just mean that you're willing to just go, I want to watch a show, but I'm going to go attend to my kids so I don't put them in front of the TV. Like my kids didn't get TV when they're little. Like you just, you sacrifice things. And that's just it.
My sister has my nephews are 5 and 7. And just like this past summer, they started to let them watch television. They'd never seen a TV show. Like they knew it was there, but they thought it was just for news.
Right. You know? And nobody will know when they are 15 that they didn't get TV till they were 7. Like my son. Oh yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. There's occasional Disney movie and some Sesame Street type stuff. And now like there's like snippets of like Star Trek episodes that my brother-in-law loves. So they're like all about like Star Trek and space stuff. And, you know, they're two little boys. It's very cute. But they're grown up with all of the attention that they needed. Instruction, teachable moments, lots of hands-on love, reading, crafts, creativity. These boys can entertain themselves because their creativity and their imaginations and their curiosities have been nurtured.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right. You have to put the time in early to see the benefits later. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think I'm going to buy this book for everyone I know who just had a baby, and there are quite a few of them. And in the show notes, if you're not driving, scroll down the show notes and there are links there to buy Bethany's book, Dr. Bethany Cook's book, and you should give it to everybody that you know who has little children or
get it on Audible.
Little children. Yeah.
Yeah, it is on Audible as well. So if you want to listen to it, it's just even easier when your
while
hands
you're doing
are with
dishes
kids.
And
announcing
the baby or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, do you, and this is a sort of ridiculous question because I kind of already know the answer. Do you use music therapy with your children at home? Like the power of music and energy, do you use
Absolutely.
It with your children?
Yes, 100%. It sets the tone of the house. We have music playing a lot. Music therapy isn't just listening. So I'm also teaching my kids piano. And it's not about they'll be great musicians someday. It's about finger dexterity. It's about discipline. It's about sitting there. And I'm not a tiger mom in that way where I'm like, you will play this chord or you will not get up kind of thing. It's
right.
Okay, let's come back to it. So it's a very genuine flow. When the kids want to learn and play, we learn a song. And when they don't, they just practice stuff that they already knew. But I thought I would actually be doing a lot more music with my kids than I do. And when I think about music therapy, there are a lot more therapeutic interventions and things, but I'm like, I'm a mom with my kids. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
So I once in a while will bring up my bag of instruments and let them play with the different instruments and the tones. And we talk about stuff.
Pots and pans and pot lids and spoons and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love it. You know, I have this really cool ocean drum. It's called an ocean drum and it's really big and it's clear on one side. You can Google ocean drum and see it, but essentially it has a bunch of BBs, like metal BBs in one side. So if you just turn the drum, it makes a shh.
Oh, nice. Like one of those rain sticks.
Yes. But then when you shake it, it's a lot of thunder and you can do it over their heads. And there's that vibrational feeling that they get from drumming that I think is really fun. So yeah. I do use music a lot, but it's primarily used in what we talked about, the ISO principle. If I see that they're wound, I'll crank them down that way instead of saying, we got to go. But again, I have to be in tune as well. I got to be knowing what my kids are feeling and thinking. And I have to be two steps ahead to think, where are we going to next? Is it bedtime? Is it this, I need to change the music, change the set scene and change the mood. But I use it an awful lot.
And be aware of your own.
Yes.
Energy and mood and vibrational change and
exactly.
all that stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, that whole conscious parenting thing, you know, you gotta be aware of your own stuff and how that's affecting your kids.
And sometimes I'll tell them, I'll be like, my kids are 8 and 6. And I'll just be like, listen, I'm in a mood today. If I ask you to do something, please just do it. Because I don't want to overreact to something. And it would be really helpful if you could just, you know, but I'm not taking it out on you. So often of the kids, I'll always say, you can be mad. Of course you can be mad. But what you don't have a right to do is to take it on everybody else in the house. Yeah. So you can sit there and be mad. If you're going to like shout and throw and hit, you can do that elsewhere. We don't need to be a part of that. But I always validate their experiences and their lived experience. And I always apologize when I mess up. And I always model, you know, remorse and tear and repair in relationships and stuff.
Because we all make mistakes.
Absolutely.
You know? With the best of intentions, you know, if I'm in a crappy mood, and I could very easily snap at someone.
Yeah.
You know, and then I'm like, oh God, I'm sorry how that sounded. I feel really bad. You know, I'm sorry about your feelings. Can we please erase that? You know?
Yeah. We call them redos. Let's try it again. Definitely. Yeah. And so if they come at me and they're in a mood and they say something, I'll say, listen, I need you to go figure out how to say that in a better way, because how you just asked me, I'm like, that sounded really ugly. So go try again. And we'll see, because that's the other thing that I think parents, I know we're probably out of time. This is the last thing I'll say. The other thing parents do is that they think that it's authority. I say, do this, do this. And if the kid doesn't obey, but like, we don't obey like that as adults. Why are we teaching we're not going to put our kids in the military. Why are we doing that to our kids? It's about if you ask your kid to do X and they say, well, I want to do Y, then how do you make it so that both situations can be met? Maybe they can do X and Y at the same time, or maybe X first and then Y, or maybe the parent even says do Y, but make sure you do X. And I will oftentimes give my children that little leeway, and I'll say, listen, I'm trusting you that when I say you're going to do this, you're going to turn around and do it. Yeah. And then if there's been several times that they don't, I'll just say, we can't do that anymore. Do you remember 2 times ago or last time? So we have to rebuild that trust again. That's just giving people a chance. That's all we're doing. Yeah. Like, we have to just chill, be understanding with ourselves, with our kids. Absolutely.
Yeah. When you're done with this activity, whatever that is, when you're done with that video, when you're done with that game, I would like you to X, Y, and Z, you know,
right.
Whatever the task is. I used to do that with my kids when they were teenagers all the time. Like, all right,
great.
I know you're in the middle of 6 things now, but by 7:30, I want these 3 things done. And how you do that is up to you. I just want it done by then.
That's perfect. That's the way to do it. They need autonomy. If they don't do it, then obviously as parents, we come in, we help teach them the skills to be able to do that. But giving children autonomy like that, that just empowers them. It doesn't entitle them. I'm so sick of, oh, that kid's entitled. Why? They can put their dishes in the sink themselves, or they can, you know, do this or that, or
do their own laundry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk to a teacher respectfully about something they don't understand.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for your time and for this amazing conversation. I enjoyed every second of it.
Oh, I did too. We're obviously soul sisters somehow.
We've got a lot of stuff. Awesome. So in the show notes, there'll be all different ways that you can contact and keep in touch with Dr. Bethany Cook, all sorts of social media links and where to buy her book and so on. So please like and share and rate the podcast and all that happy stuff. Thank you so much, Dr. Bethany.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of Permission to Heal. I hope you found it moving and inspirational. Please remember, you don't need anyone else's permission to trust and follow your heart. You have the power within you. Subscribe to Permission to Heal so you don't miss any new episodes, and please share this with your friends.